Don't you know, we're talking about a revolution. Sounds
It's the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. And I'm your host, Walt Thiessen, co-host Gene DiNardo is going to be joining us in just a moment. In fact, I think, not quite here with us yet. It is currently Thursday, December 13, 2012. And here are some of the headlines we'll be looking at today. There's a lot of news coming out of Syria, both a report saying that the Russian envoy is claiming that the Syrian leader is losing control, plus Gene has a report about any chemical arsenal that they may be having problems with there. There's also a report that Goldman Sachs got hit with an absolutely puny fine, and one of the commissioners of the CFTC blasted his colleagues for the size of that fine. Message from the Fed may be pretty much the same as it was before in different words. There's a little op-ed that I saw in, I believe it was the Dallas Morning News, that had an interesting take on it, interesting from the point of view that they really missed the boat. There's also another report Gene has about wasteful spending on Homeland Security. There are new arrests in the LIBOR manipulation scandal. And there's also a report of a massive bank cyber attack. We're going to be talking about that. But the big story this hour is the news coming out of Syria and the situation with President Assad. And Gene, I believe you're on the line now with us. Welcome to the program. And what have you been digging into where Syria is concerned?
Well, this article, it's pretty much, it has a little more information than what we've been getting about the chemical arsenal and what Assad controls and what he doesn't. But I think what Bill brought up, has brought up a number of times and got me thinking about, you know, the similarities to what we've heard before and what kind of proof that they have or don't have about this. But I'll just read some from the article because it's kind of revealing in what they don't mention. But it says, growing fear that war in Syria could unleash the world's first use of chemical weapons in nearly three decades is based on two grim scenarios, neither considered likely, but both carrying risk of civilian massacre and a major escalation of violence. The first of that is President Bashar Assad, in a last-ditch effort to save his regime, would order chemical attacks, either as a limited demonstration to scare the rebels or to show his willingness to use a more in a large-scale offensive designed to turn the tide of a conflict that has already killed tens of thousands. The second scenario is that some portion of Assad's arsenal could be moved to Iran or Lebanon or fall into the hands of foreign fighters with ties to terrorist groups who are helping Syrian rebels. It doesn't even mention that it could fall into the hands of the rebels. And it goes on to say that Syria has never confirmed that even his Syria has never confirmed that he has that it has chemical weapons, but is believed to possess substantial stockpiles of mustard gas and a range of nerve agents, including sarin, a highly toxic substance that can suffocate its victims by paralyzing muscles around their lungs. James Quinlevin, a RAND Corporation analysis who studies the elimination of weapons of mass destruction, said Syria is thought to have hundreds of tons of chemical weapons material, including not only sarin but and mustard gas, but possibly also nerve agent VX, which, like sarin, kills by attacking the central nervous system. Then it goes on to talk about when Saddam Hussein used both sarin and mustard gas on the Kurds. That was in 1987 and 88, and that killed thousands. Here's some critical stuff. It says the precise dimensions of Syria's chemical weapons arsenal are not known because it has never been subjected to outside inspection. Experts say it is a formidable collection, but the weapons date back almost 40 years when Assad's father, Hafiz Assad, began accumulating them and have not been modernized. For example, the arsenal apparently does not include weapons that combine or mix chemical ingredients after a shell or missile is fired. Instead, the mixing must be done manually before launching the weapon. That quote was from Aram Nurguizam, a Mideast security expert at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. And it goes on to talk about the warnings the U.S. has given Assad. It mentions that the warnings have not included at what point any kind of intervention would occur, whether it would be when there was a threat of a strike or an actual strike. The U.S. Special Operations Training Team is in the neighboring Jordan teaching troops how to secure chemical stockpiles, according to one current and one former U.S. official briefed on the matter. The official and ex-official spoke on condition of anonymity because they were not authorized to discuss the issue publicly. It's kind of interesting because it's not much more than we've heard. And they're, according to this article, they're going back 40 years to what was in the country or claimed to be in the country 40 years ago. You kind of wonder. I don't know what the shelf life on that stuff is. Probably a long time, but again, it's kind of a scare tactic. But I suppose it's a possibility. And you know, he finds he's going to lose power, he might do something completely desperate. The other option that I think is very dangerous is, if this stuff exists, it will still exist if he loses power and, say, flees the country. So it's not a good situation. But again, we're it seems a bit on this paranoid side, I think, the fact that they don't have intelligence or they're not telling us about intelligence. I don't know. Walt, have you heard anything to that effect?
I haven't heard anything one way or another, to be honest, although I suspect that the CIA isn't going to tell us much anyway. So,
even if they do, right?
The only time they ever tell us something is if they want to raise funds for it, you know. But what we do know is that today, New York Times and other news agencies were reporting that Russia's top Middle East diplomat and the leader of NATO offered very similar assessments of what's going on with Syria's president. The Russian diplomat in question is Deputy Foreign Minister Mikhail Bogdanov. And his assessment is basically that Assad is losing his grip. And this is not something that he said happily because Syria and Russia are allies. But he said, quote, unfortunately, it is impossible to exclude a victory of the Syrian opposition, unquote. And his remarks were reported by Russia's Interfax News Service and came as the Secretary General of NATO, Anders Fogh Rasmussen, told reporters in Brussels that Mr. Assad's use of ballistic missiles, which ties into your report, Gene, which Western officials monitoring the Syrian conflict reported on Wednesday, in which Syria has denied, reflected his, quote, utter disregard, unquote, for Syrian lives. Mr. Rasmussen also predicted the demise of Mr. Assad's government. He said, I think the regime in Damascus is approaching collapse. I think now it is only a question of time. So there is a combination of stories we have today that suggests that there may be these stockpiled chemical weapons, and that they, like you were saying, Gene, they may be getting close to either being used by a desperate leader trying to hold on to his stranglehold on the Syrian government, or it could be something that falls into the hands of the rebels. Either way, big questions arise as to, first, whether they exist, and second, if they do exist, how they're going to be used, or is there going to be somebody over there with some common sense who realizes, no, we just got to, you know, keep these things safe.
Yeah, that's surely something to be considered, and you know, with these types of weapons, nuclear weapons and chemical weapons, those weapons of that sort, whenever something like this happens, you know, they go somewhere. I mean, that was one of the big fears in the when Russia, the Soviet Russia collapsed, is what would happen to all these various countries. I don't know how many there were, but they were all bonded under Soviet Russia. Now that it was dispersing, and basically all of them had nuclear weapons, and luckily nothing negative has come of it since then. So this is the same situation, and it's always going to be this way when these leaders have weapons like this, and you know, governments do eventually fail. It's just the way it goes.
That is often the case. Meanwhile, on this side of the Atlantic, we have our own problems, as usual, that we're dealing with on a regular, ongoing basis, problems that just don't seem to want to go away. And one of those problems is the Fed and their ever-expanding money supply system, in which they figure that there isn't enough money at any time, so you always have to print more of it. One of the stories that I spotted this week was based on commentary that the Fed had made, and this came out of the Dallas Morning News. It was an opinion piece by Jim Mitchell, an editorial writer at the Morning News. And I want to read it to you because I think it does two things. First of all, it shows how, to a small degree, the voices of the status quo are beginning to come around to our viewpoint in at least the same, having the same tone and warning of dire possibilities. But it's also important to see what the differences are in what they consider to be dire and what they consider to be likely. So just reading from it, it's only about four, five, six paragraphs, something like that. It says, while Ben Bernanke's Federal Reserve has been far more transparent than Alan Greenspan's central bank, it is not within the Fed's DNA to send direct messages like they delivered yesterday. The Fed linked its policy to a specific unemployment rate number, 6.5%. Previously, the Fed had indicated that they would keep their supports in place until sometime in 2015. Now, is there really a difference? Well, mostly in tone. Economists believe that it might take until 2015 for the jobless rate to drop to 6.5%, i.e., to approach a normal pace. Interesting what they consider normal, huh? And while Bernanke says the rate isn't the target, the announcement seemed designed to give investors and others a more specific early warning of the Fed's thought process. This is the sort of Hail Mary move a central bank makes when fiscal policy, the stuff Congress and the White House are responsible for, is in disarray. I don't know how many more signals Bernanke can send and in how many different ways before Congress and the White House decide to help the Fed paddle. What Bernanke didn't really say, but probably intends, is to step up easy if the nation goes over the fiscal cliff. That makes a lot of sense to keep the economy afloat. But if the Congress and the White House were doing their jobs, the Fed wouldn't have to resort to unusual and prolonged methods to stimulate the economy at the risk of eventually unleashing inflation whiplash. If things go sour, we shouldn't blame the Fed, but we should have more than little anger at the Congress and the White House. A few interesting little tidbits in that, don't you think? First one being that he actually acknowledges that all this creation of money supply actually leads to an inflationary whiplash. That's not something we've heard a lot lately, except here on the show, of course. But you know, most of these pundits and apologists for the status quo, they rarely admit that could ever be a possibility.
That's
but
true.
Here's a case where he actually admits it. The second thing
I actually
is
heard an interview yesterday that was similar, where the guy that was analyzing the same thing that was in your article, Bernanke's latest words, and he was saying that they were throwing out the inflation aspect. You know, he said the two goals of the Federal Reserve in their policy is to keep inflation at bay and to keep people employed. And then he said it wasn't that they were throwing it out, but they were going to push and you know, keep an eye on inflation and only stop the stimulus if inflation got too bad or whatever their target went above their target. So that's along the same lines.
It's similar, right. Now, of course, we have to recognize that what they consider inflation and what you and I consider inflation are two entirely different cans of worms. What they consider inflation is anything that rises above what the official inflation rate, which of course is around 1 or 2%, and which we've discussed numerous times here on the show as being, you know, a bunch of hogwash, because true inflation is a lot higher than that. They don't acknowledge that higher inflation actually exists, so they're only looking at that so-called low inflation rate. But they still acknowledge that it's a risk, that there's a definite possibility / probability that we're moving out of even that zone. I suppose that once, you know, everybody notices that all their expenses have gone up and they can't afford to make a hand and mouth come together at the same time, maybe there's some inflation going on around here.
Yeah, then they'll go, why, what happened?
And somebody else says, oh, no, there's no inflation. It's only 1% to 2%.
Yeah. We're just leaving a zero off.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was interesting, the way they're looking at it. And he used the phrase Hail Mary there. And it seems
well,
like...
Well, that's,
you know,
what I was going to point to next. Yeah, exactly. But the Hail Mary he's talking about is the idea that perhaps the Fed's going to get involved in a little bit of more monetary creation in January to help offset the fiscal cliff. And what's really interesting to me about that is, as our friend Bill reported a week or two ago, we already know the Fed are going to do that. They've already announced it.
Yeah.
They've already announced they're going to be monetizing they're going to monetize 90% of U.S.-issued debt from now on, which is, you know...
along with all the other securities they're buying, the mortgage-backed securities and the bad debt. So it's just they're just going hog wild.
So I have to wonder about what's this guy's name? This editorial writer for the Dallas Morning News, Jim. My computer's giving me a hard time. Oh, there it is, Jim Mitchell. I have to wonder if he's actually paying attention to what the Fed had been saying. But nevertheless, putting that one aside, he considers the Hail Mary to be the Fed bailing out the White House and the Congress, and so he concludes that if things go sour, we shouldn't blame the Fed, we should be blaming the Congress and the White House.
Yeah.
So that's a really interesting claim to make.
Not that they don't deserve some.
Absolutely they deserve some. They deserve a ton. But
the other interesting thing is the connection.
But let's try to keep a perspective here about what actually happened. This is a Fed-created problem. It has been a Fed-created problem for the last 20 years. It's been building and building and building. It reached a climax in 2008. It burst. It's now being rebuilt again through even more of the same methodology. Of course it's a Fed problem. It's been a Fed problem every step of the way.
Well, they have done a remarkable job of obscuring that, and I think that basically it's education or lack of it, but it goes beyond that, you know, just that it, I don't know, other than, a few of us and, you know, libertarians and not even conservatives, old traditional conservatives, nobody has really, even after this great crisis, it's still nobody brings that up. You know, it's always something else. It's, these guys were just going crazy, you know, these power broker financial guys, the banks were going crazy. People made stupid decisions. People still believe that. I mean, and not that that stuff didn't
occur. Well, they did make stupid decisions, but that wasn't the root of it.
Right.
Yeah.
So they've done a remarkable job in their PR, if you can even call it PR, I guess. But the other the other thing that's interesting is they're putting so much weight on the fiscal cliff, and I think this ties into this whole Keynesian, the way the mechanics work. You know, they really, I mean, at least they understand that. You know, there's so much of this spending coming from the government, and they know when that is automatically cut back, like it's supposed to be, if it actually comes to fruition, they are saying, hey, look, you know, we're not going to have this stimulus, this government stimulus, so we're going to be in a bad way. And I think they look at that more heavily than they weight the tax increases, although they'll have an effect. But I think that's down the road. Because I understand it's a year till that. Well, actually, it's not a year because it'll come out of people's paychecks probably starting in January, I guess.
Especially where payroll taxes are concerned.
Yeah.
But the thing that really strikes me that continues to get lost in the wash of this fiscal cliff, and it even got lost in the wash with we did a little online radio debate at the Millenchart website this past Sunday, and we had one person from each of the camps. We had a liberal, a conservative, a centrist, and a libertarian, and none of them seemed to latch onto it. I was moderating it, so I had to be careful about what I said, but I really wanted to interject a few times, and in fact I did interject a couple times just because there were some statements made that I knew were just, you know, totally divorced from factual reality, and nobody was challenging it.
Nobody was challenging. Well, I listened to the first.
Put that aside. The point that I wanted to make here is that these cuts in spending, these cuts in taxes that they're talking about, didn't even exist in 2008. What we're talking about is cuts in spending since that were increased since 2008, and now they're cutting back to levels that don't even go back to 2008.
Yeah, they're actually cuts in increases of spending.
That's right. That's what a cut means.
Mm-hmm.
And as for a cut in defense spending, what they mean by a cut in defense spending is that they are not being allowed to ratchet up defense spending at the rate they originally intended to, really starting around 2001 with the 9/11 attacks, but inclusive right through the Bush administration into the Obama administration. After the financial crisis of 2008, they still wanted to keep ramping it up, and now they're finding, well, we can't really ramp it up that much. The Republicans are really hating that because they don't want to see any of that cut.
Well, it's interesting you use the term ratchet, because I saw a saying just the other day. It said government spending is a ratchet, and the handle goes both ways, but the socket only turns one way.
Yeah.
They were talking about the same thing. They were talking about how when they talk about cuts in spending, they're talking about less of an increase in spending. You know, they're instead of going up 10% for this department, it might only go up 5%. And, you know, I just thought it was unbelievable. Republicans, you know, shouting at Obama about his cuts in defense spending and how he was just butchering the Defense Department, et cetera, which is just absurd, you know, because it's just absurd. I mean, it's still going up so much. I mean, that's one of the fastest increasing departments as far as percentage-wise every year.
If you believe the Republican rhetoric, then the United States Army, Navy, and Air Force are about to be disbanded. And if you believe the Democratic rhetoric, if you believe the Democrat rhetoric, then Medicare, Social Security, and Medicaid are all about to be disbanded.
That's a good way to put it. That's an excellent way to put it. And, you know, they both have their little and you know, both of them would still spend ridiculous amounts on both of those programs, although possibly the Republicans would go after stuff, you know, because they'd be trying to go after those programs for a long time. They would probably go after those programs a little bit more a little bit harder than the Democrats would go after defense, because Democrats spend crazy on defense. You know, Clinton, every Democrat has. So it's just spending.
Republicans spend crazy on the social programs, too. They just claim that they don't.
They just claim that they don't, or they act that they're against them.
If the other guys increase it 250%, you increase it 125%. You saved money.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, the Medicare question is really, you know, that's a mind-boggler, because what they're talking about, the latest thing, and, you know, of course, everything changes day by day, but they mentioned going to 67 for the initial year for Medicare. And you just start to wonder, you know, with the health cartel and the costs of health care, it's just that, you know, at what point... You know, you got to cut spending, but, I mean, what are you going to make it, like, pretty soon, 72 years before you can get Medicare, you know, or just make it at some age so most people are dead before they can collect it? I mean, the cost of health care to elderly people after they retire is just getting unbelievable, you know, up to where it's like $15,000 a year or so, and people on limited incomes can't afford that. So it's really a fix the country's in, I think. You know, either way, what do you do?
Yeah, it is a fix. In fact, we're experiencing it in my family. My mom's elderly now, and she suffers from bone density problems and ended up having a couple fractures in her back as a result of the osteoporosis. And she went into the hospital for one day. She was out of the hospital, and then she went into what we would term rehab over the course of, I think it was like 4 or 5 weeks, something like that. And her total bill for rehab care is somewhere in the neighborhood of $16,000.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. I mean, it's remarkable.
Yeah.
And look at the thing they're trying to say. They're trying to save Medicare. This is a program that doesn't cover all your medical costs. It doesn't even cover most of your medical costs.
No, you have to get the assistant or the other.
And there's so many little restrictions and requirements and so forth built in that a lot of the time, even if you're eligible for Medicare, you still can't get the coverage. In order to get the coverage, you have to, you know, bend over backwards and touch your nose to the ground. Which of course you can't really do when you're elderly, and
that's why they have that restriction.
Yeah, if you try to do that, actually you end up getting injured and going to the hospital. But this is the program they're trying to save. What does that say about where we're at, say compared to, you know, 50 years ago? Everybody loves to talk about how wonderful Medicare is, how much of a godsend it has been. And yet we have now been reduced to the point where the only kind of medical care that most senior citizens can afford is a kind of medical care that supposedly is free, but it's not, and a kind of medical care which has helped to drive up the cost of health care, even though nobody's willing to admit it, and a kind of medical care that doesn't actually provide medical care. What a combination.
Yeah, so what's left? But, you know, the alternative, of course, is complete poverty.
Well, the only reason we have the choice between those two extremes
is we have
basically a system of entitlement, and we have funded that system of entitlement with debasing a currency. That's essentially how we've gotten to where we are today.
Yeah, it all plays together. It really does. And the medical industry is the other portion of the entitlement. We've taken out all competition. You know, it got the laws and restrictions and requirements, and besides the fact that the government pumps tons and millions of dollars into the medical industry, which of course inflates prices, and as you mentioned, the monetary inflation. I mean, this is like the perfect storm, and I think the healthcare system is a great example of it. It's maybe the center of the perfect storm.
And you've touched on what is the really key root thing that people should be noticing but aren't. They pumped so much money in medical care, and medical care is so much worse. You would think at some point people would make a connection between the two, that the creation and the pumping of massive amounts of money actually makes the situation worse.
That's right, and there's two examples. There's plenty of other countries that are far better. They don't have the economic advancement we do. They don't have anything we have. You know, if you go by the World Health Association, who ranks every year, they rank all the countries. We're way down there. I mean, way down. And you know, countries like Mexico are above us. That's one example that other countries are doing it at half the cost, a third of the cost, you know, getting it. And, you know, with different methods, you know, all kinds of different methods. You know, some are more socialized, some are less socialized. And then you go back to what this country in, early 1900s, where it was so much more affordable. And, you know, there was, even if people got care, there was no government mandates yet. The doctors provided care to those who couldn't afford it. They kind of socialized it, actually, because what they would do is charge other people more in order to have their free patients get some kind of care. And, you know, we had much less advanced care. You know, we didn't prolong people's lives for years and years and years with extraordinary treatments, but we did get care to the people, and most people had it. And, you know, that is somewhat of a... that it wasn't a perfect system, of course, but it was certainly was a lot cheaper.
I think it's also important to point out, I take the World Health Organization numbers with a grain of salt.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, all they're really measuring there is cost. They don't really do a good job of measuring quality of service. And the one thing that I can say about the U.S. medical system, despite the claims that a lot of opponents like to make, and I'm certainly an opponent, but I don't make these claims because I know they're not true. The U.S. medical establishment, in terms of its knowledge, in terms of its expertise, is clearly among the forefront in the world.
Yeah, so, I agree.
You know, so if you want to argue about quality of care as part of the picture, then I think you actually have to take a real look at what happens in many of these countries, particularly. Well, actually, they're virtually all socialized medicine. There really aren't any that are not socialized. But particularly in the context of what people actually get for this so-called less expensive medical care. Typically, for instance, if you want to see a doctor, sure, you can go see a doctor. And if you're in England or Mexico or Sweden or whatever else, in one of these other countries that have this kind of medical care. But if you want to actually talk to the doctor for a bit, good luck.
Yeah. Well, I think
you'll be lucky if you get 1 minute out of them.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's that's the way it's kind of parceled out, right? And here the whole question is I totally agree the quality is unbelievable. As long as you are insured or can afford it, there's no problems with quality. I think I think Mexico is very free market, for a medical system, I believe. I think what happens is I know the pharmacists have a huge role down there. Basically, you walk up to a pharmacy and, of course, all the, they don't have the restrictions, the patent restrictions on the pills and everything. So all that kind of medication is really cheap. I mean, unbelievably cheap. And the pharmacist actually will sit there and ask you what's wrong, and he kind of performs the task of a doctor and gives you the prescription directly. And then you can just walk right into a doctor. They do have insurance, but actually the fees for doctors are very low, and the care is actually pretty good. It's nothing like, they don't have the technology we have, of course, or anything like that.
Right, and as you pointed out, they don't have the patent and copyright system.
They don't have the patent systems. And we've talked about...
That patent system makes a huge difference.
It's ridiculous. I mean, I think we've talked about on the show what's called reimportation, where there was actually people... they go up to Canada and buy truckloads of these drugs, which are sold at like half the cost of the same exact drugs produced in the United States, sold at half the cost in Canada. And then they'd bring them back and make a small profit selling them back in America. And that was actually a law passed to make that illegal, even though these drugs are manufactured in the United States. So it's not legal to bring them back.
It's a bizarre thing, no doubt about it.
It is.
Well, we are halfway through the show. Let's take a break. And then after the break, we're going to take a look at some of the other stories we've been looking at, including what's the latest with the LiveWorth scandal and looking a little bit more at the spending here in the United States. Gene, you did some investigating as to what's going on with Homeland Security, so we'll look at that as well as a few other stories. This is the Freedom News Hour Surviving Meltdown here on the Progressive Radio Network, and we will be right back. We're back here on the Freedom News Hour Surviving Meltdown, Walt and Gene, on this Thursday, December 13th. And LIBOR manipulation scandal back in the news again. This from the New York Times on Tuesday, an article entitled Rate Inquiry Accelerates with Arrests in London by Ben Protest and Mark Scott. I'll just read a few paragraphs. It says, American and British authorities are shifting to an aggressive new phase in their broad investigation of interest rate manipulation as they identify potential criminal targets and complete settlements with some of the world's biggest banks. In a sign of the escalation, Britain's Serious Fraud Office made the first arrests in connection with the rate-rigging inquiry on Tuesday. In a pre-dawn raid, police took three men into custody at their homes on the outskirts of London. One of the men is Thomas Hayes, 33, a former trader at UBS. Former trader at UBS and Citigroup. That, according to people briefed on the matter who spoke on condition of anonymity, the other two men arrested worked for the British brokerage firm RP Martin. And British authorities, they say they typically make arrests in the early stages of an inquiry, and the actions on Tuesday don't necessarily signal that the individuals will be charged with wrongdoing. Interesting. How about that? You get arrested, but you're not charged with wrongdoing. UBS, Citigroup, and RP Martin declined to comment. So not really sure exactly what these arrests are going to amount to, but it does raise the question of, first of all, how much longer we're going to have this LIBOR thing stretch out. I suspect it's going to stretch out for quite some time. And second of all, when is an arrest an actual arrest?
Well, I was going to ask you that. Can you actually be arrested and detained without any charge other than, say, Guantanamo, you know, the security stuff? Is that actually legal in the U.S.? Is there a certain period of time or...
Well, remember, these arrests took place in Britain.
Oh, this is Britain. Okay.
Britain. So their rules are a little bit different. They don't have a watered-down constitution like we do. they have a constitution called the Magna Carta, which basically gives the government the ability to do almost anything it wants to, and you know, a little bit of a tip of the cap to civil liberties. But
are they on the guilty till proven innocent deal, or is it just like us, innocent till proven?
No, they're innocent till proven guilty, but they don't have the same level of habeas corpus. They do have habeas corpus, but then again, we don't have the same level of habeas corpus that we used to have. So
yeah, it's very muddy.
I'm not really sure how meaningful it is anymore, but yeah, it's rather disturbing that these people are being arrested without being arrested, that they're not actually necessarily going to be charged with anything, but they're being arrested in relation to the biggest interest rate scandal of the last century.
Yeah, and I assume they're still, were they still at their jobs? I mean, you know, there's always the fear of somebody's going to take flight. I mean, that's why they arrest a lot of criminals. But if it doesn't appear to be that, what's the point? I mean, they can talk to the guy at any point. You know, they're just
there is another clue in the New York Times article, so let me go back and read from it. It says, the evidence against Mr. Hayes is considered a linchpin in a broader case involving UBS, the Swiss banking giant. UBS is expected to settle accusations that Mr. Hayes and other employees carried out a scheme to push interest rates up and down to bolster trading profits, according to the people briefed on the matter. The people said the expected settlement, which could come as early as Friday, would include more than $450 million in fines and wider sanctions, the largest penalty to date related to the rate-rigging inquiry. Building on the momentum in the UBS inquiry, authorities are preparing a spate of civil and criminal actions. after gathering thousands of internal bank emails and interviewing dozens of employees over the last 4 years, regulators and prosecutors are using the evidence to negotiate settlements with banks and draw up arrest orders for individuals. So I think the answer to your question is we don't know yet, but something's brewing.
Yeah, they're kind of using it as leverage, it looks like.
Right.
Building the case, and then they're going to slap them with some fine.
Well, they're also going to make some arrests of some individuals. What I suspect is happening, and I can't prove this, of course, is that what's really going on in the background is they got to make some arrests because they got to look good. So they're going to they're in the process of trying to decide who the ball guys are, so that they can make it look like this was individuals acting in a rogue operation, and this was not central bank directed. This was not directed by the directors of these large banks that were involved. This was just rogue operations gone amok.
Rather than industry-wide, right?
Right.
Which is
basically do whatever you can to keep the lid on the idea that this is policy.
Right.
You don't want that. You don't want this to ever come out as being policy. You don't want that ever to be even mentioned.
Which was similar to what happened in Iraq several times. Of course, we don't really know what happened completely, but where, you know, a few individuals will get prosecuted, and they made sure to let everybody know it wasn't any kind of policy, which it probably wasn't widespread, of course, I mean, because that would be atrocious. But, yeah, they just a cover-up is what they usually
Well, speaking of cover-ups, there was another piece of news that came out this week. Again, something that got very little attention, but the New York Post did pick up on it. Their headline is, "A Puny Fine for GS Goof." And GS, in this case, of course, is Goldman Sachs. Let me just read a couple paragraphs. "An outspoken regulator lashed out at a $1.5 million, that's million, dollar settlement between Goldman Sachs and the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, calling the deal a steal for the Wall Street Bank. Bart Chilton, a CFTC commissioner, described the cash amount as puny and a slap on the wrist when compared to the whopping $8.3 billion trade at the center of the case. In 2007, a Goldman trader hid the outsized trade as the market unraveled. Chilton said this is another example of where puny penalties send the wrong message for these guys who are breaking the law. It's not even a sneeze for them, he said of the fine, which is roughly equivalent to what Goldman's CEO, Lloyd Blankfein, would have pocketed in 1 week in 2007 when he earned $68 million. Chilton was the sole dissenter on a 3-to-1 vote to fine Goldman. CFTC Chairman Gary Gensler, who worked at Goldman Sachs for 18 years, recused himself from the case. The Goldman case centers on Marshall Taylor, a former Goldman trader who allegedly established an unauthorized series of complex derivative trades totaling roughly $8.3 billion and hid it from his superiors. Notice that pattern there, hid it from his superiors. The superiors didn't know anything about this.
No, no. What was that figure again they didn't know anything about?
$8.3 billion.
They didn't miss that.
It would be awful hard to miss that. Now, I have to admit Goldman Sachs is a big company, and they deal in big
Not
numbers.
Not that big.
But that's pretty big. Yeah, even for them, that's a good size boo-boo.
Well, when these fines, when they're so small, and that's pocket change, you know, they're just a cost of doing business, a small cost. I mean, to me, every dollar in profit that was made from a transaction that's fraudulent or deceptive should be paid back, and maybe more. I mean, every single dollar. Why should they get to keep anything above what they made?
Oh, absolutely. But notice the pattern here. The pattern is the CFTC slaps the wrist. One of its members complains that the wrist was slapped, and the whole business of wrist slapping, the main purpose of it is to make sure that everybody understands that the higher-ups knew nothing about it.
Yeah.
That's the purpose. That's the real thing going on here. You don't want to make it look like Goldman Sachs actually knew what was going on.
Well, if I remember correctly,
acknowledging that on an industry-wide basis is the moment that everybody starts looking at the central bank, because the central bank is ultimately where all these directions come from in the first place.
Well, yeah, and they'll look at the entire system. If I remember correctly, AIG, which was lost $160 billion, or was on the taxpayer dole for $160 billion as part of their losses. That was the same. Wasn't that the same scenario where the one guy was blamed for it, and the company kind of divorced himself from it and said, "Well, we didn't know what he was doing. He was up in his office, you know, and he was doing all these transactions. We really didn't have a clue what he was doing."
That's always the way it is.
Isn't it crazy?
You'd have to go company by company to realize it, but every single bank, every single large player, AIG, GE, all the rest of them, every single one of them. The storyline has been the people at the top didn't know what was going on. It is such a consistent storyline. You would think that alone would become an eyebrow raiser at some point, because apparently these multi-billion-dollar companies are run by people who never know what's going on.
No, and somehow they manage to keep making a profit.
Which of course is ridiculous. Of course they know what's going on. They have to know. Otherwise, they couldn't continue to make those profits. They just couldn't do it. That's the whole point of management. And it's not like we live in a society where management is decentralized.
Yeah, no kidding.
We live in a culture that believes in authoritarianism.
Yeah, it's very hierarchical, and you can trace that. I mean, what they're saying is this guy who was not at the top made these decisions for an extended period of time over and over, without anybody above him knowing. And then that's just ridiculous. I mean, once, sure, you know, somewhere in some bizarre case where he was able to hide $20 billion or whatever it was. But over and over again, yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah, it's such an obvious pattern. And I think we can actually point to a model that has been used for a number of decades now for how you sell this idea that the higher-ups don't really know what's going on. And that model is the federal government. And indeed, you were doing some digging into one aspect of the federal government, which it's going to show us in a few minutes how much wasteful spending there was in that particular branch of the executive. But it will show that the higher-ups didn't really know what was going on. The minions were the ones who were guilty of, you know, whatever it was. And basically, the president, you know, he was out of the loop entirely.
Yeah, an interesting recent example is the lady that was one of the candidates to replace Hillary Clinton. Her name's slipping my mind, but
Susan Rice.
Yeah, exactly. She comes out to talks about the Libyan attack, and notice how it just stopped there. Then she finally has to apologize. You know, they said, "Well, it was the information," but they won't say, "Well, you know, the CIA maybe," but they didn't want to. Actually, it was the correct information, but they didn't want to say that. So what they do is she was out there in the public. She made the statement. They're not going to let it get anywhere above her. You know, it's just something she said. But on the other hand, you know, they don't want to destroy her because she was a candidate. So they don't say that, you know, it was totally her fault. It's just some kind of mix-up, but nobody above has any kind of culpability. And, you know, it's just...
But she has withdrawn her name for consideration for, I guess, with an ambassadorship. So, you know, it does have at least some personal consequences for her. But you're right. It's the buck stops there. It doesn't stop at the top.
Well, tell me this. Do you really think that she just made it up? You know, somebody told her to say that. I mean, this is my opinion. It's not like she comes out there and just starts talking. And yet, even though somebody told her, you know, or some agency or, you know, a whole bunch of people told her exactly what to say, nobody's going to say they did that. So it plays right back into what you're talking about. You know, it's just everything comes from above, yet nothing is ever... whenever something goes wrong, and it always does, nothing ever, nobody ever admits it came from above.
Well, it's fiction, and it's left-wing fiction to boot, so you definitely have to take it with a grain of salt. But on the other hand, the television series The West Wing had quite a few advisors and contributors who had experience within The West Wing for various administrations. And the storylines that go on in that series include a number of instances where different people in the government were pursuing, you know, different ends that weren't necessarily what the president's ends were, and there's this constant struggle going on to see whose storyline can win the day.
That's
so it's very possible that somebody's storyline was being played out, and she became the voice of that storyline.
Right.
And that storyline lost the power struggle, so therefore she ended up having to, you know, take the weight of the public concern, so to speak.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, it's a struggle. It's not like they're all, you know, in agreement. That's for sure.
No, I mean, you know, that's the nature of authoritarianism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everybody knows best, right?
But I do.
But you did some digging into Homeland Security. What did you find in terms of spending there? We know that they're wasting the money, but how are they wasting it?
Well, these are just these are almost comical, these examples. And what this comes from is Homeland Security Department doles out a bunch of money to the local localities, municipalities, I think states, and supposedly the idea is to help them be more secure. And Portland, Oregon, that's where I live, actually, is an example of this, where our mayor originally refused to cooperate with Homeland Security because it was a certain amount of voluntary cooperation where they would ask the local police department if they would directly cooperate with Homeland Security, and the mayor said no. And what that did was cut off any of the funds, of course. That's most how the federal government works. And then eventually he caved in because he wanted the money, you know, so he could spread it around. But here's some examples of projects that Homeland Security has, local projects Homeland Security has funded. $21 for a fish tank in Sequin, Texas, a small town outside of San Antonio. $98,000 for an underwater robot in Columbus, Ohio, where there are no major rivers and few lakes nearby. $24,000 for a latrine on wheels in Fort Worth, Texas. A Bearcat armored vehicle bought with a $285,933 grant in Keene, New Hampshire, a small New England town that is home to an annual pumpkin festival that draws up to 70,000 people. So I guess those are somehow related. $250,000 for security upgrades, including $9,000 in signage at Lucas Oil Stadium in Indianapolis. So that's some of the worst examples. Of course, you know, there's examples of the money just being spent on security that are wasteful all over the place, I'm sure, but they don't mention these. So this was a 54-page report by Senator Tom Coburn, who's a Republican from Oklahoma. And he said in the report that, well, much of the spending for the department's urban area security initiative, and that's where what was funded through, appeared to be allowed under the program's rules. It was still inappropriate in an age of budget austerity. And as there he is, budget austerity, in an age of budget austerity. And as the federal government faces a $16 trillion national debt, so it was kind of going back and forth with that report. And Senator Joe Lieberman, the retiring chairman of the Senate Homeland Security Committee, said the Coburn's report makes some good points. The program's benefits outweigh its flaws. He goes on to say the grants, for example, have helped improve first responder communications between different jurisdictions and levels of government. A lesson learned from the 9/11 attacks when scores of New York City firefighters died because of poor communication. Coburn wasn't shy about shouldering some of the blame for the program's failings. He said any blame for programs in the UASI program also falls on Congress, which is often more preoccupied with the amount of money sent to its cities than with how the money is spent or whether it is ever needed in the first place. So not judging whether the entire program is wasting money, there's some obvious examples that you know, it's hard to control these things. Anytime the money's doled out like that, it's doled out to all these cities, and, you know, they're not keeping an eye on everybody.
Well, I think we should make a few points. First of all, I think we should make the case that Homeland Security is actually not necessary, because it isn't necessary. The whole claim that it is necessary is one of those tissues of lies that sounds good on the surface, but when you look deeper, you find that there isn't any truth to any of it, that, in fact, if if the departments of the government that weren't communicating last time need to communicate, then by God, they need to pick up the phone. And if it means that Congress has to say, you guys have to communicate, if you don't, certain sanctions are going to happen, then that's what you do. You don't have to build a whole new department just to make sure these guys communicate. It doesn't have to work that way.
Well, and then all the different programs they institute, the X-ray programs now that they now use, which people were worried about, you know, being viewed naked in some room, which control room, which I think it's pretty much still true, except the private parts are covered to a certain extent in the on the screen. But that's a program that Europe has gotten rid of. And speaking of communication, perhaps we could have investigated before they spent millions and millions of dollars on that, whether it would be effective and why Europe got rid of it. And yet they go ahead and spend the money like that. And the money is there and it's spent. That's just
it's clear though. They didn't spend this money because we needed it. They didn't spend it because it was going to give us real security. They spent it because it helps to perpetuate the lie that we live in an age of fear and doubt, where we have to fear from people living in caves in the middle of Afghanistan, Pakistan. As a particular graphic that was going around the web pointed out, we have a lot less to fear from those people who are living in the caves in Afghanistan and Pakistan than we have to fear from the men and women wearing suits in Washington, D.C. But the other thing I wanted to point out about the Coburn report is that it's really quite ridiculous. He's talking about the need to cut back on $16.5 trillion debt by going after programs that waste $91,000.
Exactly.
Senator Coburn needs desperately to take a course in remedial math, because if he did, he would realize that $91,000 is such a tiny, tiny fraction of 1%. In fact, it's so small that it's less than 1% of 1% of 1% of that $16.5 trillion debt. It is so ridiculously small that it shouldn't even be in the same conversation. It's like comparing your daughter's allowance with, say, the expenditures of the state of Virginia.
The other way to look at it is when you do a report like this and you come up with these menial little piddly things, what that does, it kind of justifies the program itself. It says, well, look, we've found this, we're getting rid of this, the program's okay. So all this other money that's spent, which is billions and billions of dollars, is in question. And, like you just questioned it, you questioned the actual need for any kind of program at all. He's not questioning the billions that are spent at the airports, the billions that are spent all over the place. He's questioning, the fish tank, the loo, $24,000 for a loo. Interesting thing about this, that Portland was able to spend $120,000 on a portable bathtub, portable latrine. So what's $24,000,
$24,000 among friends, right?
Yeah.
Well, we've got just a few minutes left here in the show. I want to go to one other article that ties into all this, because Homeland Security, I mean, their argument is it's done much more good than harm and so forth. But I would argue that it misses a lot more than it catches. And another example that came out this week, this article is from CNN, but it was reported in a number of different news outlets. Security firm McAfee on Thursday released a report warning that a massive cyber attack on 30 U.S. banks has been planned with the goal of stealing millions of dollars from consumers' bank accounts. McAfee's research upheld an October report from RSA, the security wing of IT giant EMC Corp. RSA startled the security world with its announcement that a gang of cyber criminals had developed a sophisticated Trojan aimed at funneling money out of bank accounts from Chase, J.P. Morgan, Wells Fargo, Citibank, eBay, including PayPal, and the project was known as Project Blitzkrieg. The plan has been successfully tested by the perpetrators on at least 300 guinea pig bank accounts in the U.S., and the crime ring had plans to launch its attack in full force in the spring of 2013, according to McAfee. I won't go into all the details, because the bottom line here is that because they know about it, it's becoming much easier now for the banks to close the loopholes and so forth, although they're discovering that their systems are a lot more infected by malware than they had realized. But where was national security in this? Where was Homeland Security?
That would be a good job for him.
I mean, one of their biggest claims all along is we have to go after cyber criminals. Cyber criminals are a threat to the national security. Where were they on this one? They missed the boat entirely.
Yeah, it takes McAfee, a private company. Wasn't his founder just committed himself or something? Is that the...
Well, yeah, the founder was living in Belize and recently got deported to the United States after a series of negotiations he conducted while on the run because he was, in his words, we don't know what the story is yet, but in his words, he was being falsely charged with the murder of his neighbor by a Belize government that was basically acting out of vindictiveness. And the reason for the vindictiveness is that McAfee's, or his name is John McAfee, John had been criticizing the Belize government over the last 9 months, I think it was, over a variety of areas of corruption within that government, and this is their way of striking back at him. So not only do we have him on the run finally landing in Miami, I believe it was a couple days ago, but his company unearthed it, but they provide details on something that was unearthed by another private security firm, basically a massive attack on the United States, on U.S. citizens, on their bank accounts. And the Homeland Security just missed it entirely.
Amazing. Well, I'm really surprised that hasn't occurred before.
Oh, it undoubtedly has occurred before. The question is, how many times has it occurred without us hearing about it?
Well, that could be too, right?
And with that, we are nearing the end of the hour here. But, Gene, it's been a pleasure as usual, just the two of us this time. But it's been a lot of fun, if nothing else.
Yeah, and I did listen to part of the Sunday show. It was pretty interesting. And I listened to the part where you were commenting that everybody was agreeing from the different camps.
Yeah, it was quite interesting. If you get a chance, you can hear the show at nolanchart.com. Well, that's about it. We'll see you all next time here on the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. Goodbye, everybody. I'm starting to turn.